long time ago. I've been following this other flight that I'd like to see get off the ground. I think within a year, the Dawn flight, and that's supposed to by 2011 will be going to an asteroid, Vista, and then Ceres. It's actually going to go to two of these things, but it's not only just going to, it's not going to just bypass, it's going to orbit one thing, and then eventually leave orbit and orbit another one. So it'll be the first spacecraft to ever do that. It will orbit two independent celestial bodies. You know, orbit one and leave and go to another one. So that'll be the first time that they'll do that. So that's, you know, it sounds like a very good, you know, interesting technical orbital mechanical type of flight. I know there's a lot of fines that they want to get from the asteroids and all, but to do something like that, I think it's going to be pretty amazing. These two asteroids are located in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. Ceres is like the biggest one. In fact, they consider that a dwarf planet now, you know. So, it's round. Vista is not as round. It's a little smaller. So, it would look like the size of Texas, you know. That's kind of the diameter. That's pretty much it for now, Dick. We'll turn it back to you. This is WSQN.
Okay, Paul, thank you for the space report. I think you told us last week that both Spirit and Opportunity are dragging their front right wheel. I think it's the exact same wheel on both craft that failed. And so therefore the craft maneuvers itself by backing up and dragging that wheel. Is that true? Excuse me, Paul.
Yeah, they don't run it backwards all the time, but you know, when they want to make a long run, they see a high amperage coming back on the telemetry. So yeah, they'll run the craft backwards, and it will just drag along. There's other things, you know, that have gone wrong too. In the beginning, the Opportunity has a failed motor on one of the arms, and this happened three or four years ago when it first landed. They compensate a lot. They know enough to leave this arm in a certain configuration before they make a move, before they know it won't get locked up. And there's a lot of limit switches that have failed, and they think from, you know, the side of joints eventually breaking, large temperature points, they compensate for that. And they, you know, what it amounts to is, like, an old car. You know, you're just going to keep this thing on going no matter what. There's no new car service up there on Mars. Thank you.
And the unmanned missions are doing great service, gathering data day in and day out. Mars has got ridiculously cold temperatures. Something like 0.5% of the atmospheric pressure we've got on Earth. Winds that blow 200 some odd miles an hour. And it's a dry desert. Not a great place to visit. So I'm not sure you want to send an astronaut there. An unmanned mission. Although it's a little slower. It's a much nicer way to go. Also glad to hear now that the solar arrays on the International Space Station are more balanced. Turns out all of these particles that have been emitted by the sun constitute a solar wind. The solar wind, if you have any unbalance and non-symmetry of your structure of the International Space Station, the unbalanced, how much area of solar panels you got out the starboard side versus the port side, is going to create a twist. And you have to start using, you have to continuously use up your reaction control gas in order to keep proper orientation. And so now that it's more balanced, they're going to be saving that reaction control gas. I wonder if they mentioned anything along those lines. No, go ahead. I mean, Paul, go ahead.
I haven't heard anybody mention it. I think there's more of a problem with the rarefied atmosphere. You know, there are molecules up there from our atmosphere. For instance, if you put the space station in orbit around the moon or Mars, around Mars, that's at this altitude, they'd be there for years. You'd never have to worry about them deorbiting. The early Viking missions to Mars, for instance, those two landed, that they landed there in 1976, they had, a mothership that attached to each one of them. And those things were in orbit, taking pictures for years. And these things are still in orbit around Mars. They really doesn't decay. If you don't have this atmosphere like we have, you can't go up too high for an orbit. You're getting close to the Van Allen belt. You get fried with all the radiation over time. So they like to keep the thing at about 230 nautical miles or something like that. The space station survives in an area where there are little pieces of atmosphere floating around. It does tend to degrade the orbit over time. So they have to use, like you said, thrusters. On the most part, they have three gigantic gyros located in the Z1 structure. The thrust structure, and these things are spinning at a high rate of speed, and that keeps the station stabilized. When they had the computer failure last week on the Russian side, there's no computer to control everything, the attitude of the space station. So you would wind up eventually, well, saturating the gyros. Essentially what that means is, if you think of a gyro or like the old spinning bicycle wheel, and if you go to turn it, it doesn't want to move, but if you turn it on enough, you could push it and make that thing move. That would be saturating that gyroscopic movement, and they compensate that with thrusters on board the space station. They have plenty of them on board with the fuel that they keep bringing up with the progress ships and refueling the space station every time they flight. And, they have other backups. They have used the Progress spacecraft that's attached. This is the cargo spacecraft that goes up there every couple of months. And they will also use the Soyuz spacecraft if needed to compensate. And when the International Space Station is attached to the space shuttle, to maneuver the whole space station to keep its attitude correct. And actually, they don't like to do that. Like I said, they're using up fuel somewhere. And with the bisymmetric look of the spacecraft now, I don't think you're going to have that problem. You might remember the Mars climate orbiter that was supposed to go into orbit around Mars. That thing was lost. And one of the reasons they think that thing was lost was because the antenna was okay, but they had solar arrays sticking out only on one side of the spacecraft. And over time, that might have moved a little one way or the other. And I heard a report that they wish they had, a balanced system on there that was supposed to eventually go into orbit, never did. They say that it's mixed up with the American metric system, but also part of it, I think, was the imbalance of the spacecraft as it's flying through space, and that's in the middle of nowhere. And that was from the solar wind, like you were talking about there. Back to that WS wind. Thank you.
about that, then I got called away. I called away the second fall. I fell asleep also. That was nice. Stayed up around the clock. I hope you didn't ask me a question at the end. Is that true, Paul?
Most of my field A is one delta, which is right here, but mostly CW, and that's exactly where on your system. It's amazing. That's without going anywhere. So, understood, big thank you.
Okay, now, Mel, we're not going to go super late tonight, but why don't you choose a couple of the more burning emails you received. And once again, I say, please don't send emails where you ask what brand name of rig you should buy. Those are not really good TechNet questions. K2KEY, H-U-R-E-W on the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Then I'll look through and see if I can see anything of interest quickly. I guess I'm a little bit on the tired side also. It was a full day and get our share of fresh air, I won't say that much. Go through I really didn't, you know, pick through it that well. So, I can't think of one which would make for sensible. Wait. What is this? Let me just look this over. Okay, alright, here we go. It looks like heads tails it. Oh, okay. The Barry's on Dan, not with us tonight. This is right up his alley. He was interested in phased array for the amateur band and hybrid couplers for electrical control of the field pattern. And this person goes on to say, listen, let's see, I'd like to make such a hybrid. How do I go about making a hybrid to actually the injection one injection stick also to divide into two equal parts, creating a phase shift. I would assume a 90-degree phase shift. I guess that's what you're looking for. I don't know. Let's see. That's a whole thing here. And a whole business here. But, alright. I want to say a few words about, I would assume we'd look at something like a quadrature hybrid, you know, with made from transmission line, so that, we could use some kind of a steering system for a phased array on then, on 40 meters. Okay, all right. So, I guess that's basically what he's looking at. All right, let me take this one first. It's pretty straightforward. I guess you could build it around the 20 quadrature hybrid. I think that's what he is looking for, to give you a electrical control of the field pattern somewhat thick. Go ahead.
Okay, when it comes to hybrids, there are three-port hybrids and four-port hybrids. The three-port hybrid is called a Wilkinson hybrid. It really is a 2-to-1 power divider. 50 ohms in and a pair of 50 ohms output, and they're both equal in phase. And there are places where that's handy with phased arrays. The four-port hybrid can be made as a quadrature hybrid or a 180-degree hybrid. Quadrature hybrid is quite popular. Quadrature hybrid at VHF frequencies and above can be built in strip line and microstrip method of construction, printed circuit board-like construction. At 40 meters, you can build it with inductors and capacitors, lumped elements. Mini circuits has some rather inexpensive ones that would work very well for a receiver, but I don't think you can transmit through them. But mini circuits, you know, these are $2 type items, not very expensive. You go to their catalog, temperatures of high frequency range, and they've got the four-port quadrature hybrid. Quadrature hybrid really means you've got one input port, two output ports that are separated by 90 degrees in phase, but equal in power, and the fourth port gets a termination. And with various combinations of those quadrature hybrids and the equal phase Wilkinson hybrid, you can do all kinds of magic with switching networks. And as I said, at 40 meters, almost all of these can be built with inductors and capacitors. You don't really need strip line and transmission lines. If you Google the word quadrature hybrid, I guarantee you'll find a whole lot of articles. There is some coverage on the subject, I believe, in the ARL antenna handbook. I don't think it's well covered in the radio amateur's handbook. I'm trying to think of some other book. A darn good book on this subject, extremely good book, is Holland Howe, H-O-W-E, Strip Line Techniques is the name of the book. Very, very good book. And I think it's in the second or third edition. I've got the first edition. Lots of good quantitative data in there. Photographs, diagrams, charts, spreadsheets, on what performance you're going to get with what kind of a physical setup for those hybrids. A good technical library will have those books. I haven't looked, but I'm guessing that the fourth edition of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, the 2007 edition that came out last week, with all the extra chapters they added, almost positive you're going to find quadrature hybrids and Wilkinson hybrids and 180-degree hybrids in there. The 180-degree hybrid, if you build it in waveguide, it's called a Magic T. If you build it with a ring of coaxial cable, it's called a ring hybrid. If you build it with lumped constants, it can be built with transformers, inductors, and capacitors. And those are the more likely techniques when it comes to 7-megacycle circuits. I wish I could recommend a good book that will tell you how to use hybrids. And I think the best book I can think of on that is a series of books, three volumes, called Phased Array Techniques. I have trouble remembering the name of the author. And this is a book that was popular.
CTK.
Say again?
I suggested this to Barry when he got interested in, you know, the phased array. Henry W2 Charlie Texas Pillow wrote that hybrids and couplers. He did quite a bit. He wrote a whole book on that called High Frequency Hybrids and Couplers. I looked that up for Barry.
If you said W2CTK, Whiskey 2 Charlie Tango Pillow, that's Hank Keen, and I worked with him for a whole lot of years. And he had a whole series of articles on that subject in Ham Radio Magazine. Is this the same guy we're talking about, Mel?
Roger. I knew him as Henry. I guess he was published under the name Henry Keene. I guess, yeah, Hank Keene. And W-C-T-K. And that was a specialty, I could say, of a number of articles. I believe it was all bound together in a... I don't remember who put out that book. You may be right. It may be in Ham Radio. I don't remember, but I know there was a published article all grouped together on high frequency hybrids and couplers for the ham radio operator, Dick. And in fact, I think we covered it in one of the. We covered it in one of the Smith charts. Tutelage is about determining a system, I could say, with a phase shift or a 90-degree phase shift, you know, having 180-degree out of phase with each other, and using a cancellation system. I think we went through that whole thing, how we did that by... using lengths of coax cable, and we had some capacitors and and some of the doctors I completed had pretty much, you know, paralleled some of that, and I believe you'll look back, you'll find it, Dick, over.
Okay, let me tell you a repeat story with a little spin to it on Hank Keene, Henry Keene, W2 Charlie Tango Kilowatt, who used to live in Comac and worked for about 35 years for Airborne Instruments Laboratory, as I did, although we didn't completely overlap in the years of service. When I studied microwave engineering at Pratt Institute under a guy named Dr. Howard Boyette, did a good job of teaching it to us, but he taught it more from a physics point of view more than a wireless electronic engineering point of view. And I thought the subject was kind of boring. So as I left the school, I said to myself, I don't think I'm going to work in microwave engineering. Start working at AIL, my first job, there about a month or two, and we're in this great big sea of desks of engineers in this great big room, and I'm hearing this snapping sound. No one can relate to that compared to what happened over the last 24 hours. I'm hearing a high voltage snapping sound. That, that, that. And I got curious and said, what the hell is that? Walk across the hall, and there was this great big high-power microwave waveguide circuit with something like a 10-kilowatt Klystron tube and a ring resonator, which brought it up to 10 megawatts, and he was testing rotary joints for Hank Keene. And so the arcing I'm hearing was 10-megawatt arcing across a L-band piece of waveguide that he had set up in his laboratory across the hall from me. And with those interesting sounds, I walked over there and started talking to him. And over the next 5-10 years, he taught me most of what I know about strip line. He's written some books on the subject, quite a bit about hybrids, and he showed me what microwave engineering is really like. Very, very different than what I was exposed to it in school. All of a sudden, that became my reason for existence, microwave engineering. So Hank Keene was the guy who did that. Hank eventually retired, moved to Fox, Arkansas, and started building phased array antennas for 40 meters in Fox, Arkansas, and wrote a whole series of articles in Ham Radio Magazine on the subject. I don't think Hank ever published in QST. I think he did all of his publishing in Ham Radio. He liked the idea that they paid some number of dollars per page. He liked getting paid for his articles. So you'll find a number of good articles on that subject with Hank. You're also going to find, when it comes to phased array antenna techniques, a little bit more highfalutin you're going to find in the appropriate chapter of Antenna Engineering Handbook. You're also going to find a fair amount of predicting the antenna pattern for various ways of electronically steering an antenna pattern. That's what phased arrays are used for, electronically steering the pattern. In any of the issues of Krauss's book called Antenna, and there's 3 editions of that. And as you go to the higher number of the editions, you get more and more diagrams, more and more pictures, and it becomes a nicer and nicer book. But any of the Krauss books, the first edition was 1950 McGraw-Hill. The second edition, I'm guessing, was around 1980. I believe you got the second edition. I think it was given to you as a gift by your very complimentary wife. And I think I own also the 3rd edition of Krauss. So in those books by Krauss, you will find quite a bit of electronic steering information. It is a subject that ham radio in general has made very little use of, electronic steering, for a whole bunch of reasons. We just haven't gone there, and we should go there. I think the basic reason why we amateurs haven't gone there is that just understanding phase shift gives a fair number of hams a fair amount of grief. Picture a dual trace oscilloscope, and you've got a pair of equal sine waves on the dual trace oscilloscope, one right above the other, completely aligned. And if one of those waveforms starts shifting to the right or the left compared to the other, you are viewing graphically what phase shift is. And so measuring it in time delay difference, measuring it in degrees of phase shift difference, measuring it in nanoseconds. There's various ways that you can quantify phase shift. But once you understand phase shifting circuits, just a variable length coax cable can do that for you. That's the basic portion of what creates electronically steering. If you've got more than one individual element to your antenna, like for instance putting two Yagis one above the other, or two Yagis side by side, and you shift the phase of the signal you fed to one Yagi versus the other, you are electronically steering that beam. And there are times when that can be very handy, a lot of fun, once you understand the concept. So those books I mentioned, Krauss and the Antenna Engineering Handbook by R.C. Johnson, and the new one, which I've got right here, and I can't think of the name of the bad guy, Volakis, V-O-L-A-K-I-S, John L. Volakis, from the Ohio University Electro Science Laboratory. So he worked at the right hand of John Krauss. And by the way, I learned an awful lot of my microwave engineering from a theoretical point of view from a school in Brooklyn. Mel also went to a school in Brooklyn, but he learned a lot of his microwave theory from a school in Ohio called Ohio University. And from time to time, he ran into John Krauss himself. So Mel and I do a little bit of name dropping. Back to you, Mel, for any further comments on all this from KQRW in the group.
Good.
Yep, Roger. Anybody else want to ask any questions about any of the above before I make some final comments? If you have time, if you'll have to do it, I'll pull another one out. Anybody else would like to question anything about phased arrays? Okay, as I said, we had done a similar tutelage of a hybrid type of device that we computed out, we did work it out for a fact, I guess you did substitute the numbers in, and this person is looking for, that wrote in the email, he's looking for around 7.2 megahertz, and you can make it out of length of coax cable. Just real quickly, we did lay it out fairly well based on John Krauss' work. And this gentleman that worked with Dick, Henry Keene. Now, it's funny, you know, Henry Keene, I did run into him one time with Dick, but I wonder if that was the same guy, because he had changed his call letters, and he was out in Arkansas. Maybe, I don't know, maybe the same person, but there was a person that I looked up. I did some research that time for Barry, because he wanted to basically, you know, work along the same lines of this, and this person, Henry Keene, was out there with the call letters of W5PRS, Thomas Romeo Santiago. Would that be the same person out in Arkansas? Dick, over.
Absolutely. W2CTK, Hank Keene, Comac, Long Island, retired to Fox, Arkansas, picked up the call letters of Whiskey 5, Tango, Romeo, Sierra. Whole series of articles, Ham Radio Magazine. He now is a silent key. I visited him in Fox, Arkansas, by the way. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, so I guess you can find that information, and this will really give you good insight into how to put together such as a, you know, for experimental purposes, 7 megahertz phase type system. It's very cheap, I think, that, you know, you're not going to invest very much in the way of money to try it out, because basically all you need is a couple lengths of coax cable, and I mean short lengths. You're going to wind up only with, you know, some piece of scrap cable, basically. I bet you have around the capacitors, you know, are very cheap. Well, we did work out a system that time that basically were using variable capacitors just to get us in a ballpark. And once you really, you know, put this whole thing together, you can put fixed capacitors and things like that, and and the method of switching and everything like that to be done with, I guess we can use some old relays and things. So it's not an expensive thing to, experiment with it. I think we'll say it's not going to have any explosions or anything like that. Nothing's going to burn out. So, and I think we wound up using basically L-network type of coupling, matching, I should say matching, with a coupling with the use of L-network. So there's quite a bit of information on this. We did have this discussion in depth. So this is KQY back to KQRW.
Now the subject of quadrature hybrid, it goes under a number of names. Quadrature hybrid, 90-degree hybrid, directional coupler. In most cases, a directional coupler, whether it's built in waveguide, microstrip, or lumped elements, L's and C's, a directional coupler, in most cases, is a quadrature hybrid, a 90-degree phase shifting device, which takes a sample of the signal going forward and rejects the signal going back out of that port, puts it into the termination instead of the signal going back. It turns out that inside of the slug of a Bird Model 43 watt meter, the slug that you put in there where you select the frequency range and the power, that is a directional coupler. Believe it or not, built into that slug is a version of a quadrature hybrid, which samples what's going down the line. And so when you turn the slug from forward to reverse, you're either putting the signal into the meter or into a termination. That's what that directional coupler is really doing. So with those names, with those buzzwords, you will find a directional coupler built very nicely constructed in the middle of the standing wave ratio bridge that's in the ARL antenna handbook. So look for the standing wave ratio bridge, ARL antenna handbook. That thing works down at 40 megacycles very nicely, 7 megacycles, 40 meters. And that is a quadrature hybrid. It's called directional coupler. It'll show you a nice, very nice method of construction of one that can tolerate transmitting power and give you high performance. And it looks, as I remember that article in their antenna engineering handbook, that portion of the standing wave ratio bridge looks to me like it's a $4 worth of hardware. Back to you, Mel.
Roger, I can say we did cover that. I can say it's only a couple of dollars worth of hardware, and they can do a lot of experimenting with it. It's a lot of fun to do this kind of phasing of antennas and get some kind of directional. I think we were correct. We determined, if I'm not mistaken, that time when we did the coolage, that the phase system, what to expect. I think we said that it was right around 3 dB. I believe that we considered a 3 dB quadrature hybrid. I believe that's what we came up with at the time, Dick, over.
Yeah, I should have remembered. That's another name. So, 3 dB quadrature hybrid. 3 dB directional coupler. These are some of the names. And by the way, a directional coupler can be built with 3 dB, 6 dB, 10 dB, 20 dB of coupling. In other words, it's taking a sample of the signal that goes forward. You could say that the slug of a Bird Model 43 watt meter, the 100 watt slug, is probably a 25 dB coupling coefficient, directional coupler. When you make one for a 3 dB coupling coefficient, it's called a power divider. And it would be called a 90 degree hybrid, 90 degree power dividing, 90 degree directional coupler, equal power directional coupler. It's amazing how many words there are for a similar circuit. Now back to you, Mel.
Roger. I remember back when we discussed the discussion that broke off on that. In fact, I'm going to note that I have here. we showed that very good way of determining the length of the trimming piece of transmission line. You know, trimming it is to use the grid zip feeder. Very, very good application of the grid zip feeder so that, you know, you can then trim off small bits of the coaxial ray line. And it takes a lot of the guesswork because you can creep up on it very slow, especially now if you have a grid zip feeder, you can very easily, as I did, adopt a frequency counter to it so you can get very accurate readings on the dip frequency. Just be able to determine much more accurate than it ever could, you know, exactly what the frequency of the dip, the grid dip feed was operating at, Dick, over.
Yeah, I think it was either Joe or Tony who last night was showing us his grid dip meter when operating at 10 meters going into a single side main receiver. It's a very good, rather steady signal generator. You listen to it in the side band receiver. This solid state grid dip meter made out of FET transistors had very little drift to it. And by way of using the receiver, you know exactly what frequency it's on. So it's a good poor man's signal generator for testing what frequency is coming into the television. When you're getting TDI, you adjust the grid dip meter until you get the exact same herringbone pattern. It'll give you a strong hint as to what frequency is creating the current. And there's a lot of other ways of using it. Okay, you want to try one more of the emails now? Go right ahead.
Okay, this is KQKEY. Yeah, that was Tony last night. That you and him had a lot of fun with his grid zip meter. That's WW2W. That's checked in just a few minutes ago. And Dick brought along a very interesting gadget that we had a lot of hours of pleasure from. This little hand crank. I believe it was a Whiz-Am, is that correct, the pronunciation of a Whiz-Am it generated a high voltage spark that was quite fascinating to look at. I believe it said it was called Whiz-Am, is my correct pick, over?
It's called WIMSHURST. 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 Whiskey, India, Mike, Sierra, Hotel, Uniform, Romeo, Tango, Sierra, WIMSHURST. It's a high voltage generator. The particular one I own, paid $53 for it from eBay, and there's a lot of them being sold. It's a commercial product being sold on eBay. And the buy it now price is $53 plus shipping. It makes 200,000 volts. It will make a spark that jumps 3.5 inches through air. And no two sparks are the same. Each one's got a different path. Fascinating. Makes a nice snapping sound. You turn the crank and out comes 200,000 volts and a spark jumps the gap. When the machine is tuned just right, 3.5 inches, they guarantee more than 2.28 inches is the guarantee. But you tune it correctly, and you'll get well above 3 inches most of the time. And you want to study high voltage, static electricity. And is it really static or regular electricity? The thing can turn out around 8 or 10 microamps of current and 200,000 volts. The WIMSHURST machine was invented by Mr. WIMSHURST in England, 1883. That's before you really had radio transmission. You connect that to an antenna as a spark generator, and you've got a spark transmitter. And Tony operated his 10-meter receiver alongside of my WIMSHURST machine while it's operating. And my goodness, does it make static. That's even before you add an antenna to it. You add an antenna to it, and you're going to hear the noise that machine makes for 10 miles. Guarantee it. So, if you like high voltage, if you like static electricity, I can recommend a couple of good books for you on the subject. I've been fascinated by that subject for quite a few years. Now that I'm retired, that's a joke, and I work harder, but still, I've always wanted to own one of these things and play with it. And I've also got another reason why I'm playing with it. It's teaching me something that I want to know for a project that I'm involved in. So Wimshurst, I don't know the guy's first name, but you Google the word Wimshurst, you will find a zillion articles on the subject. You'll find at least 10 different variations to the design. There's a man in Buenos Aires, South America, who must have spent 5 years of his life building, hand-building, various versions of Wimshurst machines. And you read his articles, which are translated into English, and they'll tell you the relative merits and the persnickety characteristics and whatever. The good news, you just turn the crank on this machine, and out comes a lot of high voltage most of the time. It's a little bit slow starting up on a high humidity day, and some days, for whatever reason, it just doesn't want to start until you prime the pump by putting some voltage across the terminals, which it then multiplies. It's a kind of a voltage multiplier circuit. And how can fitting a couple of plastic discs with some wire brushes on metal contact and a hand crank into Leyden jars, or Leyden jars, or whatever you pronounce it, Leyden jars capacitors, which stores the 200 kilovolts, and then zaps it across a spark gap, an adjustable spark gap circuit that can be up to 3.5 inches. How can something so simple make so much voltage? And how does it really work? There are people who have spent a good fraction of a year studying how the thing does that. And the explanation is not simple. There's some real good physics there. Back to you, Mel. H-U-L-I-W.
Okay. This is K2-H-Y. Twin turn. Yes, I do. I know I wrote it down correctly, but yes, it is Matthias. I could say we did have a lot of fun with a number of different things last night. This has to be one that was so fascinating that we just couldn't seem to put it aside. Okay, it's 11 o'clock. Well, Dick, would you feel up to one more, and then we'll call it a night. This is H2KTY.
Yeah, go for one more, Bill.
Okay, I'm sort of picking through here now. It's all by the name of David. All right, David, what is what you like to know? Something about SDT. Here we go again with HF. Okay. All right, let me see what he asked about ADS. I have a limited space. And somebody told me that years ago, the old timers used a 80 meter type of bow tie antenna. And it was much better than an ordinary single wire horizontal side pole when used on the stand. For instance, a regular dipole, because of the size of the stand, it will not cover the entire band without, well, of course, using a tuner or a matching system of some sort. So, basically, can I go ahead and use the bow tie type of antenna? Bow tie antenna. Now, what the heck? Let me picture it. What are you talking about? A bow tie antenna. See if I can be a little bit more insight into a bow tie. I'm trying to remember the old time. Basically, I think there was an antenna that was basically so-called, I think they used to call it a double type Duke, if I'm not mistaken. Just search back my memory, maybe that sounds more familiar. But I think there was a bow tie antenna, but it was based on, loosely based on the double bazooka type of dipole configuration. I would think that was the first one, but I think there was something. I remember the old timers couldn't get, starting to come back to me some thoughts about it. I think the old timers didn't have, in many cases, the availability of copper wire. And I think they would use galvanized wire for this type of thing. Maybe it's retail. I have to think this out a minute. Go ahead.
Yeah, the so-called bow tie antenna, built as a skeleton structure, a real bow tie antenna, which is a kind of UHF popular antenna. It's a sheet metal bow tie with a slightly three-dimensional bend to it, in front of a corner reflector. The Bowtie Corner Reflector UHF antenna was very popular 20 years ago. And a skeleton version of it for VHF television reception used to be called a double conical antenna. And so, if you build an 80-meter version of that, I almost do not recommend that. Because unless you've got a lot of real estate to devote to this, you're not going to get a very many wavelengths of width to the bow tie at the end. The bow tie antenna literally looks like the bow tie that you wear with your tuxedo. And it's a kind of a fat dipole made out of sheet metal in the UHF version. So the tips of the dipole are nice and wide, and you do get some extra bandwidth out of it when you build it out of sheet metal. When you build the skeleton slot version of it, which looks like a double conical television aerial of 1960, you don't get quite as much bandwidth improvement. And an 80-meter version of that would be kind of massive. I don't think it's going to give a great deal of performance improvement. The pattern will not be any different than an ordinary simple wire dipole. No change in pattern. No change in gain. A little bit of extra bandwidth. Instead of being the dipole being 3% wide, the double conical is going to be 5% wide. But all of that effort, just for a couple of extra percent, I think is a bad trade-off, because you can get all the percentage of bandwidth out of an 80-meter dipole you want by just buying an antenna tuner or building an antenna tuner that has enough tuning range to it. Your simple wire dipole with a homebrew or commercial antenna tuner connected to it has no difficulty covering the whole 80-meter band and then some. And since going through all the effort of broadbanding the antenna versus electronically broadbanding, since it doesn't give you any increase in gain, any increase in performance, I think it's a fair trade-off. Do it if you like, but I don't recommend it. And even if you had a 2-to-1 or a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio, correcting that with a good antenna tuner is easy. If you didn't correct it, you're only getting half or three-quarters of a dB of loss. As long as your transmitter can tolerate it, that's not bad. So standing wave ratio has had a lot of people creating a xenophobic effect where they think it's just something really bad. I mean, it's like that advertisement you used to have 20 years ago for a particular brand name of electronic shaver. Oh, no, the nub. The guy who didn't have an electronic shaver that shaved close enough, he's got these nubs on his face. And he gets all upset about it. Well, there are people who get all upset about their antenna because it's got a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. That's not so bad. It's not the end of the world. And there's some pretty easy ways of correcting it. If you're crafty enough, you can correct it with $10 of the hardware at your favorite frequency of 80 meters, even without readjusting the length or the altitude of the dipole itself. So, I think I know what this bow tie antenna is on an 80 meters. I don't think it's worth it. Back to you, Bill. TQLIW.
Okay, let me search back to my memory. Go back to my decided unit for the person when I had to really scrounge around and do a lot of things, and things like antenna tuners and all sometimes were, you know, at first, early years, was, you know, a thing that may have been beyond my expertise or, you know, possibility with, with the parts necessary. So I remember that I did put together a bow tie antenna that was basically the antenna that was used by many of the old, so-called old-timers. And this antenna, I'm going to really stretch my memory back. I'm really picturing it. I made a little sketch here, basically, trying to put back what I will tell you what I had. The antenna, first of all, I made it out of galvanized. In fact, the old-timers, they were making it out of galvanized wire. Because the availability, I guess, of copper wire, even the few cents that the cost of during the depression years of the 30s, meant that basically you had to find something that you literally had to get for nothing, and galvanized wire was around. The old timers at that time determined, if I remember, that's how the bow tie sort of became popular, that they depended basically on the difference of the cube of copper wire versus galvanized wire. I don't remember exactly how they determined the measurement of what they were talking about, basically, but I did try it using galvanized wire, and the antenna basically wasn't that big. I think the total length on 80 meters was about 100, maybe a little over 100 feet, maybe 105 feet at the most. The spread between the bow tie end were about maybe 8-10 feet spread on each end, and it gave me, I remember, a very good, it tuned very well across most of the 80 meter band, Dick. Now, this is the bow tie I'm remembering, Dick. I assume this is what you're thinking of. If you said the old timers and all, so I'm sure that this is basically the antenna that they were referencing to. I remember they stipulated particularly that they used galvanized wire in development of this antenna. Go ahead, Dick.
I'm guessing they used galvanized wire for higher physical strength reasons and not as much fatigue failure as you would get with copper. I am guessing that the bow tie was parallel to the ground, horizontally polarized, and each end of the dipole really was a kind of a loop, a triangular loop, where you could say you had two supports on the right-hand side of the dipole and two supports on the left-hand side of the dipole, as opposed to one support on each side. And so you got these slightly isosceles triangles to the right-hand side of the dipole, and isosceles triangle to the left side of the dipole with two supports on each side. Is that what the bow tie was on 80 meters, Mel? Go ahead.
Basically, what you did is you had a support on each end, and you drooped down the wires, and you kept them spread. They used to use pieces of bamboo. You know, everything was bamboo in those days, bamboo, but was a very cheap support for antennas. And I remember I got blanks of bamboo. They used to use it. There was a lot of it around here that was used for religious purposes. And they were, you know, the old time is built, the original, we talked about HJK, the JKB, John Krause's HJKB, he built it there, basically it was called the Bamboo Yagi. And so that's what I used. I used bamboo as my spreaders. I believe they were around 8.5, 10 feet. And it just hung down there to keep it spread. And that's how you formed that, like you say, those triangle corners take over.
So at 80 meters, the bamboo was creating the triangle corners, not just having a double insulator on the left side and a double insulator, displaced two insulators on the right side, and the support ropes went off at, let's say, 90-degree angles. You didn't do it that way, Mel. Go ahead.
So yeah, it looked like a big X up there. In other words, if you draw like an X, and two ends of the X with a separation about, like I say, 8.5, 9 feet, whatever it was, and then the legs were approximately about 50-some-odd feet long each leg from the center point. I think the total length of this, if I remember correctly, if the total length of this bow tie was between a little over 100 feet thick. I remember correctly. I'm very, basically very sure that bow tie antenna for 80 meters was around 105 feet at the maximum. Over.
And the right angle piece of wire at the left end and the right end, roughly how many feet long was that? I think that's acting as a top hat capacitor, and that's why part of the reason why the whole antenna is 105 feet long instead of 135 feet long. Is that approximately right? How long were those right angle pieces on the end?
That's where you use the bamboo as the spreader to hold that those corners spread. In other words, you hung an insulator at that corner and you joined on that bamboo and you dropped it down about half, maybe 8 feet, something, 8.5 feet. Then you put In other words, you put another insulator. In other words, that's what made the corner, the pieces of hanging down bamboo over.
Understand. And so you built the horizontally polarized bow tie, but the bow tie itself was vertical, perpendicular to the ground. And you could have made the whole thing horizontal to the ground, all of it parallel to the ground, and you would have had the exact same performance. Back to you, Mel.
I guess you could have had the, yeah, I think what the, some of them twisted it. You would twist it. You could twist it to, you know, either. In other words, once you put those bamboo threads, you know, in there, but what some guys, I think, did it. It was a, you know, controversy which way worked better. But what you could do, I remember that it was, you know, it comes back to you how the, an old handbook, how it was done. They, you would take in the center of the bamboo. No, you would take from either end of this bamboo and to hold it in a horizontal position, you put a weight, you know, you put a cord from each corner of the bamboo and hang down and you put a weight there so it would hold it now, swing it horizontal. This was like you went rotated it from the vertical to the horizontal. So you wanted to hold it now in a horizontal position for a period of time and make your, you know, test and all. That's how you held it in the horizontal, by those pieces of weight stick. So now the bow tie would turn 90 degrees over.
How long was the piece of bamboo, Phil?
About 8.5, 9 feet approximately. Yeah, I think it was around that thing. I know that it fit the length of bamboo that I got usually was within 10 feet. You know, they vary the, you know, pieces of bamboo growth. And I know they were all on within 10 feet thick over.
Your loop antenna where you use molding wood could have been done with bamboo, couldn't it?
Oh, yeah, but it would be a little hard to figure out how to, you know, join bamboo at the corners. Yeah, the molding, of course, is so cheap. You know, a couple of lengths of molding, 8 foot length or four. And, yeah, I guess so. Listen, you can improvise and figure out how you can do it. There's, you know, there's no set way to definitely mechanically engineer these things. But this loop was very, also, you know what, some of the guys found that it was real great because it for an 80-meter antenna, it could fit into a regular city lock because you didn't have to make the loop, especially in the horizontal position. If you had a center port, it could go sort of off on an angle. In other words, it didn't have to be a classic X looking down on it or whatever. It could sort of, you know, give a little bend to fit into your lock over.
Yeah, so I'm beginning to see some of the advantages of the bow tie. A little more bandwidth, only 105 feet of length instead of 135 feet. Therefore, easier way of squeezing it into a lot. Maybe it's got more merit than I first thought.
Now, I said, he asked, he said, was it really made with galvanized wire? And the answer was yes, that's it. The article that I remember reading now, I'm going to search back in my memory, an awful long time. That's funny that this thing all of a sudden came out of left field. I completely forgot about this antenna. I believe it was like number, couldn't have been 14, it was number 16 galvanized wire. I believe that they had a whole thing about the using galvanized wire because of the RF resistance, how is it figured into the, you know, the relation, in other words, the relationship between, I guess, loss, putting it into more modern words, of course, that I understand today. I didn't really understand the nitty-gritty stuff at the time, but thinking back now, I guess, using, like, for instance, galvanized wire, the loss, you know, resistance, and the radiation resistance, basically, it was basically, if you looked at it as a series circuit, looked at this as a series circuit, I would think that you would be able to get pretty close to somewhere around 70 ohms, thick over.
One of the reasons I think it was 90-gauge galvanized fence wire, Miles Mill, is that that was an extremely popular, inexpensive product, sold by the Montgomery Ward catalog in 1970, and I think it was also sold as a farm and garden catalog of Sears Roebuck. So number 9 gauge galvanized fence wire. was a nice sturdy material that for about 10 years I was using it for guy wires on my tower. I since graduated to a better grade of stranded cable. But could it have been number 9 gauge galvanized fence wire from the bubble? From the Montgomery Ward catalog?
No, we're going to go back. I guess it could have been even the Sears catalog. You know, this thing became popular, Dick, in the 30s. Scrounging around and everything was the only way most of, I would say, the vast majority of amateur radio population got on the air. You could, just to spend maybe a dollar on an item was a major investment for most, unfortunately, because, if you wound up at the end of the week with a paycheck that amounted to maybe $5 in many cases, that's what you survived on. I have heard stories about the Depression years, so that's when this antenna became it became. And of course, it carried over with basically my year. Like that we were discussing last week, last night we had a lot of fun discussing basically what Dick and I have gone through in our 68 years and what it was like back when we were teenagers. And basically, it was not much more than depression years in some cases for us personally, being young and not having parents that had the wherewithal give us big chunks of money when we want to put a hand check together that we could more or less ground fit together. So this was basically the situation for most of the hands of the 30s. So I guess galvanized wire, which in many cases got for nothing for the leak. Leave it to him. They'll figure out what the heck to do with it. And I remember this as the Bowtie antenna, and it did work as a very excellent antenna on 18 take over.
I recognize, but the first melt, I remember the 9-gauge galvanized fence wire came in something like 500-foot coils. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, you could get it. There was the popular size, if I remember correctly, Dick. This, I believe they called it number 16 galvanized wire. I think that was the popular Sears type Roebuck that you could go down there and buy by the foot. I believe it was, and I only remember back, this is what I believe I used was number 16. It sits in my mind, over.
Okay, let's see what Hal's got to say.
Okay, good evening, gentlemen. I was just reading the mail. Yeah, that antenna was also called a Wonder Bar antenna. And basically, it was a very broadband type of dipole because the elements extended out from the center out. So it had a relatively low Q, and it was a pretty good antenna as far as being for 80 and 40 meters for the bandwidth. Go ahead, then.
Hal, the audio on your transmitter is very heavy. It's right at the threshold of distorting. You want, might want to speak a little softer into the mic and or lower that mic gain control a little bit.
I'll talk a little softer into the mic.
Has anyone ever mentioned that to you, Hal?
Yeah, this is a different rig. I'm on an 857, so it's a little bit different than the others.
Is there a mic gain control in the front panel?
I got to go into the software.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Back to you, Mel.
And I'm getting a little tired.
Now, you had mentioned, different forms of it. Now that I come back to my memory, start to reach back for some reason, after a while, I start to reminisce for myself. There was also, if you had a situation where you didn't even have that much room, say at least 100 feet, you could take that bowtie antenna, spread the ends, in other words, when you, like I just said, instead of the ends, say 10 feet, spread apart on the ends of the, where the X is, form the end of the bow tie, I should say. You could make that wider if you had to make, so put two pieces of bamboo some way together and all make it 20 feet wide. Then you could shorten the elements down so that the total length of the bow tie from end to end could be, less. I think, in fact, the guy used to make them down to like 75 feet by just you know, making the end where the part more take over.
Take that far enough and it starts looking like a two-leaf clover.
So I assume that this could still be a viable antenna. I know that what they did, of course, at that time, you know, you used the back, the feed line, the 600 ohm or 400 ohm or whatever it was, the feed line, of course, you continued on. The galvanized wire may have most likely also wound up with open wire feeders. Later on, of course, we're all familiar with open wire feeders made out of copper, but I would assume that they were using this open wire feeders made out of this stuff, too. Now, and of course, you know, homebrew spread is made out of pieces of dowel wood, and they used to cook it in paraffin, save up the... I know I did a lot of that. My grandparents would light candles, and the candle was left over. A lot of times I salvaged the wax over.
And your food stores, you could also buy blocks of wax that we use for food canning. So getting the wax wasn't too difficult. And with that 9-gauge galvan or 16-gauge galvanized fence wire, or galvanized wire, you didn't even have to break the wire where the dipole joins the feed line. It could all be one great big continuous loop, I think. Two continuous loops, but not even a junction required. Okay. I'm going to start saying 73. If anybody's falling asleep here around now, go ahead.
Before you go, K2KYQ, can you give me the web page again? So that all I got out of it was win something.
Wins first. Whiskey India Mike, Sierra Hotel, Uniform Romeo, Sierra Tango. I get that wrong. W-I-N-S-H-U-R-S-T. I got it right, yeah. Whiskey India Mike, Sierra Hotel, Uniform Romeo, Sierra Tango. Wins First Machine. You Google that and combine that with eBay, and you'll see this Wins First Machine being sold for $53. Plus $10 shipping. Made in China. Very nicely built up product. A little bit of a learning curve to get full performance out of it, but a kind of a fun machine. Go ahead.
Thanks a lot, Dick. I appreciate that. It was really interesting listening to you and Mel. And let me wish you a good evening and a good sleep tonight. Take the KYQ. Good night.
K6DTC. Dick, is my audio a little better?
Sounding good, Hal.
Oh, okay. I reset the level on this thing. No problem. Yeah, last night, the William E. Oler's book, Radio Amplicast, a lot on the antenna you were talking about with the calculations and everything else.
Hal, you spoke softly when you asked, is it any better? And then you came back up to full volume again, and you're overmodulating again, in my opinion.
Yeah, I had a little softly. Yeah, WFIA's book, Radio Handbook, had a lot of information on that type of antenna. There's a lot of the calculations and everything that went with it.
So, I think you're saying Bill Orr, Radio Handbook. And I think that came in about 20 different editions over the years. Isn't that true?
Yeah, that's true. But I've seen it in the earlier editions and the later editions. It's a very thorough book and it went with a lot of unique antennas.
Sounds good. Thank you, Bill.
Did you like to
cut it? Go ahead, Joe. Oh, wait a minute. I got the wrong guy.
Q-I-Q?
Go right ahead, Joe.
KZ2QIQ, the name is Glenn. I had built a bowtie antenna within the past year or so, and it was actually very small. It was a really good tri-band 2048, and it was a perfect match on 20, and I think it was 1.5:1 on 80, and it was only about 31 feet across, I think 20 feet on the bottom, and it dropped with a 4:1 balance, a 300 ohm antenna, and it dropped down about 4.5 feet. So theoretically, you could fit it within you know, within a night, you know, to support them. No further away than, say, 35, 36 feet. And how you support the bottom is just with water bottles.
How about that? As counterweight. That's pretty crafty. Are we going to worry about them swinging in the breeze on a really windy day and smashing into the trunk of a tree? But I guess there's ways around that. You got to know.
Hey, it shows you what's old is new. We were discussing last night how many different things that so many years later still are viable. So, David, we're attempting to see you now. Thank you very much. I guess everybody sort of gave you a hint that if you want to attempt to send that, that you can use your imagination and look up if you can find this book that's were printed in the past. I'm sure they'll give you all, I can say, formulations and everything, or basically, I would think that you could put something like that together, and even a simple L network to match this thing. In other words, if you want to feed it with coaxial cable, you can most likely resonate it with a simple L network, which would consist of, you know, a captive inductor, and then a variable capacitor. In other words, we call it an L type of network, and I will bet you can easily get it to match with a piece of, RGAU coaxial cable instead of the open wire meters that you so-called want to do that. Most likely, can you make up a simple type of LC circuit? I'm visualizing now a small LC circuit that can be hung right up there at the feed point. So you can do a lot of experiments. It's very fascinating. Comes back, brings back a lot of memory. Okay, I think we covered it pretty good. Good night, all. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. Dick, you really had a lot of fun. I really am going to remember this as a great day. So, everybody, thank you for whoever joined, and take care. This is K2KY and the TechNet.
Bye-bye, you're welcome.